Welcome to the podcast for the Journal of the American Academy of Physician Assistants.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to this month's podcast. We're excited for this podcast episode as we have a very special guest.
Yes, but before we introduce them, here's a quick overview of this month's podcast. For this month, we'll be reviewing CME articles titled ICU Survivorship, What PAs Need to Know, and Cervical Cancer Screening Guidelines, an update. For this month's podcast, we'd like to have more time for discussion with our special guests, so we're just going to stick to two articles this month, but next month we'll be back to reviewing four.
And please remember, everyone, when you read both CME articles, review the post-test, then take the test online at cme.aapa.org, you get one category CME if you score at least a 70%.
Yes. And lastly, here's our quick disclaimer. This podcast is a summary of selected articles from this month's edition. We share our take and opinions, and they don't represent JAPA, the authors, or the editor's opinions, or the publisher. This is not intended as medical advice.
As previously mentioned, for this month's podcast, we have a special guest, Ms. Nicolette LaRosa. Nicolette is currently working in the Medical Critical Care Unit here at the Hospital of University of Pennsylvania. She is also an alum of Drexel University's Physician Assistant Program and is one of our former classmates. Welcome to the podcast, Nicolette.
Yes, welcome. Thank you for being here today. It's a pleasure having you.
Thank you both so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here. I'm really passionate about critical care, but I think that our topic today is something that hopefully everybody, no matter what your specialty, can take something and implement it into your practice.
For sure, for sure. For our listeners out there, Nicolette is the author of this month's CME article, ICU Survivorship, What PAs Need to Know. Now, before we get into the article, we have a question for you. What prompted you or inspired you to write this article?
Yeah, so I knew that I was really interested in critical care, and one day my goal would be to work in an ICU. So when I was choosing a topic for my grad project, I knew I wanted to learn more about something pertaining to critical illness. And prior to PA school, I worked at a children's hospital, helping to teach resuscitation simulation courses, and I learned a lot about the poor quality of life that patients often face after surviving a cardiac arrest. So I was curious to see if other than post-cardiac arrest patients, survivors of other types of critical illness face any long-term complications. So sure enough, when I started doing my research, I learned about post-intensive care syndrome and this booming body of evidence that's been published about it over the past decade or so. And I thought it was a great topic because I think no matter what type of medicine you practice, it's something you really should be aware of because you'll be taking care of patients who have survived a critical illness. And just to give you an example, when I was actually on my family medicine rotation in PA school, we had a patient come in. He was an older guy, and he was telling us that he was there for a hospital follow-up visit because he had been in the ICU for sepsis. He was intubated and had a long course. He was very, very sick, but ended up surviving. And when he came in, he was really upset that he felt like cognitively he was not the same as before he was sick, and he was really confused by this. He thought maybe he was just getting old, or, you know, he didn't know what was going on, but he was very forgetful and not really his usual self. So it was cool because I was able to talk to him like, no, this is actually super common after you have a critical illness, especially after you've been intubated and you've had sepsis. And we were able to talk about why. And I think it made him feel much less confused and much less alone to know how common it is. So it was cool that I was able to, you know, educate him about that. And I think it made him feel a lot better. So hopefully, you know, this podcast brings more awareness to that, because my preceptor at the time, he was a family medicine physician. He really wasn't aware of all these, you know, complications of critical illness survival either. So I think it's something that hopefully more of us can learn about and recognize in our patients.
Yeah, for sure. As a hospitalist, I know this was a very helpful article to have to go through, because part of my job is seeing the ICU transfers. So typically when they get to the floor, they are stable and probably have already underwent the ICU delirium, and their neuromuscular issues have been addressed by neurology and things like that. But it is good. I always try to use my opportunity to, as a PA, to educate patients. I always say, like, hey, anytime, I always tell patients, anytime you have a clinician in the room, you always ask at least two questions. Like, this is what we're here for. This is what we get paid for, to make sure that you're a more educated individual by the time you leave the hospital. Like, you should know what exactly disease you have, how is it managed, what are the complications. Because a lot of people just come to the hospital and just like get fixed, and because they aren't educated, they go through the cycle of coming back in to the hospital on this revolving door type of thing. So I think that it is imperative for us to educate our patients with any opportunity that we get.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, no, and I agree. And I think it helps give us a definite answer to patients too, mm-hmm. like how you're saying your patient, you know, it kind of makes sense. Like, okay, yeah, you went through a long course. Mm-hmm. It's going to take a time for things to get better. But to say, no, this is an actual diagnosis, mm-hmm. I think it gives patients a little bit more reassurance and peace.
Yeah, for sure.
For sure, for sure. Well, yeah, thank you for that. And without further ado, let's get into the article. As we have the author here, I will briefly overview the main points of the article. And Nicolette, please buzz in whenever you feel necessary or if you feel like I missed a point or something you specifically want to highlight. So the article initially addresses something that I feel that many people do not think about, the fact that many people are surviving their ICU stays. However, with every positive, there is a negative. Yes, more people are surviving, but with the survival rates, there are complications that come along with this advancement. The term that has been curated is PICS, which stands for post-intensive care syndrome, where clinicians over the year have noticed complications consisting of physical, emotional, and psych changes in their patients. And the article touched base on the cognitive decline observed in patients. And that was the first thing that came to mind when I had seen the topic of the article. I remember my first time covering in the ICU, the topic of ICU delirium came up, and the attending emphasized the importance of getting the patient stabilized as soon as possible and out of the ICU as soon as possible to help avoid similar situations like that in the future. Are both of y'all, are any of y'all familiar with that or have heard that term before?
Pretty sure you have though, Nicolette.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's super interesting because the term post-intensive care syndrome actually wasn't used as a term until 2012 when the Society of Critical Care Medicine came together with all of these people who were noticing this pattern of symptoms in patients who were surviving an ICU stay. But in my article, I kind of tried to go beyond the typical definition of post-intensive care syndrome, which classically includes physical, cognitive, or mental health changes. And I tried to give PAs sort of a systems-based approach to some common issues that patients face after they leave the ICU so that if you have a patient who's sitting in front of you, you have a framework to say, okay, these are the things I should be looking out for. So just know mm-hmm. that, yes, the typical, the classic definition of post-intensive care syndrome, it refers to those three things, but patients who have survived an ICU stay often face a much more expansive host of complications.
Okay, good, good, good. I did not know that much about PICS, but I was referring to ICU delirium.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's a huge problem. And I think, you know, even in critically ill patients in the hospital, it's a huge problem. Yeah. You know, now I work in an ICU, but prior to that, I worked on a neurology floor, and that was a huge a thing we saw with a lot of our neurology patients. And you can definitely see that the more delirium a patient has, the worse the outcomes often are, even just anecdotally. So it's something that mm-hmm. I think everybody who works in the hospital really needs to aggressively recognize and treat.
Yeah. I will say not even in the ICU, though, but in hospital medicine, I would see that with patients, elderly patients, of course, even if they're like, you know, at baseline AO times four. Mm-hmm. And I'd be surprised when they'd start sundowning. I was like, this is the patient I expected at least the least to sundown. But it makes sense, though.
It's a huge problem. And, you know, there's so much interesting research that the more severe the delirium is in a patient when they're in the ICU specifically, the more cognitive decline and all of these other issues they face down the road. So it's something that we really want to aggressively treat.
Mm-hmm. And I would say that's one thing I've struggled with as a first year PA is recognizing when the patient is delirious and when they're at baseline, because there's been times where I've spent 20 minutes trying to reason, trying to be respectful with the patient, and then just to have a nurse come in and be like, oh yeah, he's delirious, like don't even worry about anything he's saying. And I'm like, man, I was trying to, like, they were telling me about these new diseases, I was like, oh, maybe I need to check up to date on this. But yeah, it's definitely something that we should be aware of and understand, especially in the elderly population, that it's likely to come up. So, and the one thing that also in the article that appeared to be the most apparent to me were the psych issues that could be triggered by an ICU stay. It was noted that patients were likely to experience mood disorders and PTSD, and that makes sense due to the emotional trauma they experienced with being critically ill for such a long time period. And I think about you being like in situations where you're in like near death situations or like with the whole COVID thing, as mentioned in the article, where you weren't able to see your family members for a long time. And it's kind of, ICU rooms are kind of like a, not as bad, but like a prison cell. Like you're stuck into that room. Like you don't really go out of there. You're seeing the same people every day. It's a very sad thing when you're in there for a prolonged time period. It makes sense why obviously they want to get you stable and get you back to the floor where it's a little bit more pleasant. But I definitely could see why a patient could suffer from depression and anxiety with being in such a critically ill state for so long. Lena, any thoughts on that situation?
Yeah, it makes sense. And even, you know, in the article you mentioned, if they're on like a neuromuscular blockade when they're intubated, I can imagine that's super scary. It's like you feel trapped in your body. And especially if you're, you know, how you also mentioned, if you're kind of in and out of, you know, full consciousness and everything, that's, you know, scary. And I can also imagine for patients who are in the ICU for, you know, a chronic condition, like, you know, if they're in a coma from like really uncontrolled diabetes, you know, I can see how it can cause PTSD and anxiety afterwards, where, you know, I would be like, I want to make sure my glucose never gets that high again. I never want to go through that again. So, you know, it's not surprising, but I also feel like, how do we equip ourselves to deal with that after a patient goes through that and experiences that? Yeah. And, you know,
it's definitely a challenge to address the mental health concerns of these patients. But there's some really interesting data that there's a lot of overlap between physical symptoms and mental health systems in patients in this population. So, for example, among patients who survive an ICU stay who meet criteria for depression, oftentimes they have symptoms such as pain and trouble sleeping, more physical symptoms as opposed to affective symptoms like sadness and tearfulness. And so, you know, if you have a patient who survived a critical illness and they're, you know, technically depressed, but they have some more of those physical type symptoms, physical therapy and occupational therapy and more than just what you typically think of as mental health care may be a real benefit to them. And if you're interested in learning more about this, there's actually a really fascinating article. I'm sorry, I forget the name off the top of my head, but it's cited in my paper. And basically, it's called like Visions of Something. I apologize.
It's okay. But, we'll link it in the description.
Yeah, that would be awesome. But it's a very qualitative study where the authors interviewed patients who have survived an ICU stay about their delusions while they were so sick. And it's really crazy. There are people who truly believe that they are being held as a prisoner because they had restraints on and they were in this kind of foggy state of consciousness. And to hear what these people really believed that they were going through at the time is super eye-opening. It's a really cool study if you want to check it out.
That's not surprising. I mean, I always feel bad, you know, you have that patient, you're walking down the hall, they're in restraints because, you know, they're delirious and they're like, help me, help me, help me. And it's like, you know, I always try my best, even if it's not my patient, you know, to like check in. I'm like, is there anything you want? You want some ice? You want some water? You okay? Like reassure, like re-explain to them what's going on. Like, okay, in a few, let's settle down. Like, you know, because I can imagine, I mean, it's scary to witness, and I, you know, if I were to go, it's scary for them, it's going through their mind, too.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy to put restraints on patients. Sometimes I feel like we don't think about it, but they're not benign, you know, and going back to the delirium, they definitely can increase the risk of delirium. Yeah. So, something we should really be thinking about.
Yeah, reminder, restraints. Last resort.
Yeah.
And it's a tough situation, because you understand, like, the situation it puts nurses in, like having to deal with the patient that's constantly getting up out of the bed while they're trying to care for 5-6 other patients, why that is the quickest thing to do. And it can be frustrating. You keep telling someone over and over, trying to explain to them what's going on. And it is sad. I remember my first time there, like one of my first night shifts, it was an older patient who was delirious. He was like, you see me downstairs, like, please save me. Like, they're trying to hold me captive. And I'm like trying to explain to him, and like, he was getting like really sad because I guess feeling like I betrayed him. But it's just a tough situation to be in. And I guess the best thing is just to avoid it as if you avoid it when possible, and then also early intervention, as the article stated, and it also was talking about with the PTSD and mood disorders. Our jobs as PAs, I guess, especially in the primary care setting, is to address when you see a patient, follow up, ask them, I guess, go through your Sigi caps, go through all those things to see if they would benefit from seeing a therapist or psychiatrist to help facilitate those feelings that they may be experiencing afterwards. The article also touched on ICU-acquired weakness, which is a form of neuromuscular dysfunction found in approximately 80% of critically ill patients, most likely due to the risk factors of immobility, sepsis, and glucose dysregulation, to name a few. You also noted that early PT may be essential for critically ill patients, and this is a simple but yet proven intervention because we're all familiar with the concept of how physical fitness and activity contribute to a healthier lifestyle. So it makes sense as to why you would do the same for patients who are critically ill. And this reminded me, before PA school, I worked in a PT clinic, and I briefly worked in occupational medicine. And in both settings, early mobilization was emphasized for increasing, bettering their recovery, speeding up the recovery process. And even with in the surgical setting, there are a bunch of people, like everyone that comes in with a torn ACL, PCL, ACL and PCL, they all had PT, like therapy, like 2 to 3 weeks prior to the surgery. So building up the muscles, I guess building that muscle to mind connection to better facilitate their recovery process. So it makes sense that you're prepping the body for a traumatic event. And that's kind of what, when you are in the ICU, whether it's a respiratory or circulatory system, you're in, your body's going through a traumatic experience. So it makes sense to kind of have that same approach of early mobilization. As soon as a patient's able to speak with you, get them up out of the bed, get them moving, doing exercises. So I thought that was a very, very good point to make in terms of patients with the ICU, because I wouldn't initially think of it. And I also think of physical therapy is similar to our profession in the sense that a lot of people don't know exactly what they do unless you work directly with them. Because I know, like, for everyone who has a stroke, we have to put in a PT consult. Even there's some pulmonary issues, pulmonary like PT. On our... not pulmonary PT, but sometimes with like an epic, the already made like sets, order mm-hmm. sets mm-hmm. already has PT already checked off in there. And I don't question why. I just, hey, I'm going to go with this is what protocol says. This is what I'm going to follow. But I would be interested to figure out like how is PT benefiting this patient specifically with this illness. So that was a very, very good point. Did you have any thoughts on that, Lena? Or
I mean, I think also it helps with depression because it probably helps mm-hmm. empower the patient, makes them feel a little bit more confident again. Because, you know, you talked about the one patient, you know, when you can't do for yourself, when mm-hmm. you used to be able to, it's a burden. Patients feel it's a burden on their family members and those around them. And so having them also regain skills mm-hmm. And so they can be a little bit more independent, that helps improve their quality of life as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And like what we talked about earlier, when you are in such a physical state that's so different from what you were before your illness and you don't mm-hmm. feel good and it's hard to do things like you were just, you know, saying, then once you start to get some of that back, you get your mobility back, it really improves the mental health. It's all so interrelated. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's why it's so important to have such a big, you know, team taking care of these patients after they leave the ICU. You know, seeing your primary care doctor after you leave is really not enough. You know, you need physical therapy. You often need occupational therapy. You may need the support of a nutritionist or a therapist. And I think mm-hmm. having such a holistic view is really what's going to be best for these patients.
No, for real. And I think you do a good point of proving that point with all of your examples, because the next thing I was going to touch on was with the respiratory and the circular systems were also touched on, and we see how why it is imperative to frequently screen these patients for chronic conditions, as they're likely related to the system, such as heart disease, anemia, and high cholesterol. that was something that just passed my mind that I didn't even think of. Like, if I had a patient that came out of the hospital to screen them for these things, maybe if they were like a little older, or I had seen that their fasting blood glucose was a little elevated, but not simply because they were in the ICU would I screen them. But it makes sense because our body was just in that high stressed area. And then with these studies showing that you're likely to have high cholesterol, likely to have the stress induced hyperglycemia, I like when it's like a nice, I guess, bell in my head that just says, okay, like this is makes it, it's all connecting everything back to what you learned in school. So
yeah,
thanks for noting those points.
Oh, of course. I think it's super interesting that the connection between new chronic illness and an acute illness, like a stay in the ICU. And you know, if you look through the research, there's some, you know, people aren't really sure why that is. Especially in the case of diabetes, there's a strong correlation between stress-induced hyperglycemia and the development of diabetes. But also some of it, you know, for example, the hypertension and the hyperlipidemia, may be that the patients had it prior to their acute illness and just never knew. You know, oftentimes these patients who end up in the ICU, let's say, I don't know, just as a theoretical example, they come to the hospital with altered mental status and it turns out they're in hypertensive emergency and they end up in the ICU that way. Well, they probably had hypertension for a long time, but they just, you know, weren't following up with anybody in the outpatient setting because they didn't think they needed to, or because they don't have access to care or whatever. So it's kind of, it's interesting to see the connection between chronic illness and the acute illness.
And lastly, I liked how you touched on the symptoms that many people don't think of pertaining to patients who survived their time in the ICU with the like the GU system with like sexual dysfunction and thing with like skin and hair loss, because those are things that really affect people. It goes back to the mental well-being of the patient that affects their it's just a big change in their daily life, like what they were used to before. Like, I didn't even think about like having like the colostomy and the scars and like how that could lead to like body dysmorphia. Like, people may think that they don't feel that their partner may not see them the same after this stay. I had actually seen a funny TikTok talking about a girl who she had a colostomy bag. She would never. She was always scared to spend the night at her boyfriend's house, and she said when she knew. She knew when he was the one, when she finally agreed to sleep over there, and she woke up and the colostomy bag had busted. And then and she said at that point, like, she was like very embarrassed, but like he didn't know what was going on. He was like, I just know it smells real bad, but I'm really like, I want to help you right now. So she was she looked like no more like her. I wonder what was going on with her. She was like 20, probably like late 20s, early 30s. But it's that just reminded me when you mentioned that in the article. But yeah, we don't think as clinicians, we don't think of, oh, how is this going to affect their like sex life, how their intimate relationships. And we see like, we think of it as, oh, that's like, I guess like a personal issue, or deal with that like with your primary care type of thing. But it's definitely something that should be addressed. And I guess when patients, like you said before, when patients are made known about this may being an issue, like, hey, like, you're going to have this bag here, like, is your partner aware of it? Do they understand everything that's going on with it? Or you have this scar on your stomach now, like, do they understand it's not nasty, like, it's still healing, like, all these type of things that should be brought to the attention of the patient before they even leave the hospital. It shouldn't be something that they leave and have to, like, figure out on their own or end up having to come to their primary care with this issue. I really appreciated this article. Thank you.
Oh, thank you guys.
Me too.
And also, I'm glad you enjoyed it.
And I'm glad Brendan like put emphasis on that, because I was reading it. I was like, oh my God, I completely, you know, forgot about younger patients. Like, you know, God forbid. But like, if that happened to us, like, those are major issues. Like, we're in that age range that would, I think, add to that depression that you talked about, add to the, you know, your quality of life afterwards.
Even older patients, too. Older
patients, too, yeah.
You never know. You know, older patients enjoy sex. And, you know, if things aren't exactly the same as they were before you were really sick, that's, you know, a burden on our older patients, too. I think sometimes we get so set in like, you know, I have to save this person's life, which like true is probably the most important thing. Yeah. But also as clinicians, I think we have to look at, you know, the whole patient and realize that these things that may not seem that significant to us as the person trying to like, prolong and save their life, but like it can really make a big difference to them. And if some simple interventions that we can do will make it better, then it's something we should definitely, you know, try to implement into our practice.
Yeah.
For sure, for sure. Well, do you have any questions for her, Lena?
Yeah. So first of all, I want to also thank you over this last year working in the ICU. You know, the COVID-19 pandemic. And I know you were like in one of the COVID hotspots in the country at that time. And so thank you for that. But my first question to you is, as a newer PA, what was one of your biggest challenges, or even let's say biggest learning curves you faced, especially while being, you know, in the ICU, on top of that during like a global pandemic?
Yeah, so I mean, I think there's definitely a steep learning curve for anybody when they first get into the ICU. I think that my first job at a PA school, which was on a very busy neuro step down unit with a lot of really sick stroke patients who weren't like quite ICU, but probably could have been, you know, there was oftentimes multiple emergencies happening at once. And I think learning how to triage multiple, you know, fires going on, as you could say, really helped to prepare me for being in critical care. But I think, you know, critical care comes with it so many of its own set of challenges. You don't really learn about ventilators in PA school. You don't really learn about, you know, CRRT or vasopressors. And, you know, as we were kind of talking before the show about some of these problems when, you know, you have a patient who's volume overloaded, but they're also hypotensive, you know, these things that you don't really learn in school. So it's been a lot of studying on my own on my days off. I usually try to read a textbook chapter or two in this critical care textbook I've been reading. So it's a lot of independent learning. And I'm really lucky. I have an awesome team that's, you know, behind me, a really, really smart and nice group of APPs that's been helping to train me. So definitely a steep learning curve, but it's a great field. And if anybody out there is, you know, looking to make the transition, I think you should totally do it. Don't be scared.
Thank you for that. And then, Brandon, you also work in the ICU. Do you feel you experienced some of the, you know, that was like a bigger learning curve for you as well?
So, I would say not as much, because I just do like coverage there. Like, so when they need help, when someone's off, so like the attendings have been pretty nice, and they'll give me like basic cases, like, alcohol withdrawal or, hyperkalemia type of things. But I definitely noticed the importance of having a great, I guess, either orientation training period, or just having a, supportive workforce around you. In our ICU, it's always one attending and one fellow, and then one APP or physician associate. I think this is the first time I use that in real life. Just having, as a new grad, just having, making sure that you are able to put yourself in an environment where you're supported and you have people willing to help, and understanding, like Nicolette said, that a lot of the medicine that's practiced in the CCU is not the medicine that we learn in PA school. We know we go over like vasopressors maybe for like one slide, and all you know is probably like norepi and epi. I feel like with any type of specialty, there's just going to be learning curves, but just making sure that you surround yourself the best you can around a supportive workforce, and I guess management staff as well, that's understanding that you're a PA and you're a new PA and you're coming in with just the baseline knowledge of what's going on.
Yeah, even though I'm not in the ICU, I feel like that, like I said, triaging is like number one, especially when you work nights. And like sometimes, you know, I was like the only PA with like 50 patients, and it's like, do I go see the patient that's in like AFib RVR right now, or do I see the COVID patient whose pulse ox is like in the 80s? And it's like, where do I go? And then it's like, you know, especially being a new grad with COVID, it's like COVID wasn't even a thing. So it's like you're just relying on your basics and a lot of critical thinking, and I think a lot of finesse, which I think that's like a scary thing, I think, to hear as a new grad, because you're just like, I don't know, I don't have any of that yet, but No, I agree. In the article, Nicolette, you briefly mentioned having discussions with your patient's family members and the additional challenges of not having family at bedside or at the hospital at all because of the pandemic. What are some tips that you have for initiating and continuing these conversations with family members, you know, over the phone and when they can't see their loved ones in person, you know, and especially with the very unfortunate near threat of the Delta variant. I'm wondering, you know, if this is some advice that we all might be utilizing in the very near future. Hopefully not, but it's, I feel like I can imagine it's hard to like express sometimes to family members how sick their loved one is.
Yeah, for sure. I think, you know, you're right. I think when you see somebody, you walk into their room, they have, you know, an ET tube and they're connected to a dialysis machine and they have a central line and there's all these IV poles around them. It, you can walk in and easily see like, oh my gosh, my family member is really, really sick. I think, you know, conveying that over the phone without scaring them to death is certainly very challenging. But I think, you know, first and foremost, you just have to be honest with people. I don't think it ever serves anybody good to sugarcoat it. And I think that, you know, I've been really impressed, to be honest, with how much research patients' families have been doing. They have been asking me the most, like, thoughtful, educated questions. And it's really been very impressive. And it's awesome to see that people really want to understand what's going on, even if they can't be in the hospital. You know, for example, I had a patient the other day whose family member was asking about the ventilator settings, which like most people wouldn't think to ask about. But I said, oh, yeah, you know, we had to increase the PEEP from 10 to 12. And she was like, oh, my goodness, you know, that must mean his oxygen was getting a little low again. You know, like, and another patient asked, like, you know, I've been reading. I'm sorry, another patient's family member asked it. I've been reading that there's this thing called the MELD score for patients with liver failure, and depending on that, it may determine if they're a candidate for transplant. You know, have you calculated her MELD score, and what does that mean for her chance at a transplant? People are asking really great questions with what they've been able to find online. So I think, you know, you just have to really understand where people are at with their understanding. And if somebody really has a great understanding about what's going on, like, talk to them at that level. Don't you know,
dumb it down.
You dumb it down, exactly. If someone wants that level of understanding, you should like talk to them at that level. I think the other challenge with communicating with patients through the phone is like finding the time and remembering to do it in the first place. You know, when you're busy running around with all these sick patients, it's hard to, you know, make that a priority sometimes. So one of the things that they've done at my hospital is that we have a checklist that we go through with every patient. It's basic stuff like, you know, are they on DVT prophylaxis? Do they have some sort of nutrition? What's their, you know, are we going to allow them to have any mobility? Things like that. And one of the things they've added during COVID is a family communication box. That's something we talk about every day and add it to our little checklist just to like make sure that it gets done, because updating family members is, you know, just as important as any of the other care we provide. People deserve to be in the loop. So I think that if anybody out there is like struggling to remember to update the families, putting it as part of your daily checklist is something that's been very helpful.
Yeah. As someone who works nights, I emphasize that, because nothing is more frustrating than when someone starts to crash in the middle of the night and the family member hasn't been updated in 3 days and they think they're still improving, and I'm like the one breaking the news. But, oh, no.
Oh, I've been there. It's the worst.
Yeah. But thank you for that. And, you know, I think also, too, is, do you have any tips for when, you know, you've mentioned your patient population, their family members have been researching, but for, let's say, family populations or patient populations where that might not be the case, it's the opposite. There's like a communication gap, and I don't say like education gap, but maybe like a huge gap in the understanding.
Well, yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, I think my go-to is always asking people, you know, what's your understanding about what's going on? What was the last thing you heard? And I'll fill you in from there. I think that's, if you do that, you can never go wrong, because I think sometimes if you just start spewing a bunch of facts at people, or, you know, you think that somebody has heard a diagnosis and they haven't, and it just really overwhelms people. It's just understanding where they are. And I think, you know, that helps you to, one, know what they don't know yet, but then also the way they describe it kind of helps you understand what their level of understanding is about what's going on. And then you can kind of fill in the gaps and give them more information based on their level of understanding. So I think that's been something that's been helpful for me.
Thank you. I'm gonna implement that. And then just following up, another follow-up question to this topic, especially for, you know, students mm-hmm. that are listening or any other new PAs, when do you think is a good time to start having these discussions with family members or support systems about the patient's plan of care, the journey and challenges you expect them to face, the length of time or timeline, mm-hmm. So to speak, of the patient's rehabilitation? Because I can imagine having this as like the first conversation mm-hmm. can be really overwhelming. But yeah. you, like how you mentioned, you know, you don't want to set false expectations.
Yeah. You know, I think oftentimes when I meet families in the ICU, you're in a situation where unfortunately you don't really have a lot of time to build a relationship before you start having these difficult conversations. Mm-hmm. I think it's important that, you know, even in the primary care setting, these conversations start mm-hmm. with, you know, if something were to happen, if you were to be really sick, would you want a breathing tube? Would you want CPR? Would you want these things? Because oftentimes patients come in and they have never had these conversations with their families, and the family doesn't know what they want, and it creates a lot of delays and, you know, makes things really yeah. tough to know, should we escalate, should we not, because the families are going back and forth. So I think, you know, in the primary care, if you can encourage patients well before they're mm-hmm. critically ill to have these conversations, it's just mm-hmm. going to make a better experience for everybody, the patient and their family. Oftentimes families feel very guilty because they don't know what the patient would want, and they don't want them to suffer, but also they don't know, well, what if she really wanted to live and try everything? And yeah. being the one to say, no, we need to stop, is really difficult, and puts, it's very stressful for families. They don't yeah. often want to be the one that says, this is it. So if
you ask them, like, anytime you ask them on a mission to the hospital, like, say they're mm-hmm. like stable when they come into the hospital, it puts you, there's been a situation where it puts me in a tough situation, because I'm like, I'm not saying, like, it's just part of my checklist right. that I'm going through. Like, is this patient DNR, DNI
yeah.
type of thing? And that doesn't mean necessarily that they're critically happen. Ill at that moment, but I can understand the issue. Like, hey, I'm coming in for an asthma exacerbation, and you're asking me, do I want to live if something goes wrong?
Yeah.
And, like, I do think it's imperative that the providers in the primary care setting has these conversations when the patient's healthy, when they're just coming yeah. in for their normal routine blood work, mm-hmm. things like that. Because like you said, it is stressful for family members, especially when they're coming to the hospital thinking that their family member's okay, and next thing you know, they have to get intubated and no questions are answered
mm-hmm.
pertaining to the course of treatment that they want to receive.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah. I think going back to the original question, it's sometimes it's tough, and ideally if you can wait to have that conversation, if you have time, then maybe it's okay. But I think, you know, in the hospital and the ICU, earlier better, because yeah. you never know what's going to happen.
Yeah. That's like part of my checklist when someone's admitted. Like, I wait till the end, but I like mm-hmm. preface it. Like, this is a question I ask all my patients. It doesn't mean that anything's bad.
Yeah.
But in case, you know, such and such happened. And most people are pretty good. But, you know, speaking of which, like mm-hmm. how you said, family members, they don't want to be the ones mm-hmm. that are like, you know, they feel like I'm pulling the plug.
Yeah.
But I had a patient, and the family member who was advocating for them, they were on hospice and they wanted comfort care and full code, and I was like, those two don't
yeah
they don't go together, and I think it was a moment of like, I want them to be comfortable, but mm-hmm. I also don't want to be the one to make the final call on that.
Yeah, these decisions get so challenging sometimes, and I think one of our attendings the other day gave an incredible lecture about palliative care in the ICU. I think it applies for hospital medicine as well. And her big point was, you know, all of us can practice palliative care. We can make patients comfortable. We can mm-hmm. have these conversations with families. It's not really, it shouldn't be something that a specialist has to do. It's something yeah. all of us can implement into our practice. But they are there if you're having a really hard time communicating with the family. You know, you're just not getting on the same page. You can't figure out what that gap is that's allowing you to have a productive conversation about the goals of care. Then palliative care is a great resource to call yeah. if you're yeah. having a hard time.
No, I agree. And also, you know, getting them involved early is also probably helpful too. For our last question on this article, when discussing stress-related hyperglycemia, you mentioned providers should take some precautionary measures to prevent this from transitioning into type 2 diabetes. Do you mind mentioning what some of those steps providers should be taking to prevent this are one of those steps?
Yeah, this was super interesting that we kind of talked about this earlier, the, you know, new chronic conditions coming out of a critical illness. There's not actually a whole lot of data out there yet about this. We know that it exists and that stress-induced hyperglycemia is a risk factor. And we know that you can probably take steps to prevent it, but we don't know a whole lot. What I would say is the most important thing is probably screening. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe screen somebody who you know had really high blood sugar when they were in ICU a little more frequently for diabetes, mm-hmm. especially, you know, a lot of patients. After they've been admitted to the hospital, maybe on high-dose steroids or something like that, that would even further increase their risk. So just be mindful of those other risk factors and then frequently screen. And of course, back to the basics, you can never go wrong with counseling your patient about, you know, healthy eating, exercise, and all of those standard things that can prevent diabetes and, you know, your standard population as well.
No, thank you again for that, Nicolette. So, moving on to our next CME article, we're going to be discussing cervical cancer screening guidelines and update by Sarah Shammy and Jennifer Coombs. Sarah is an assistant professor and clinical coordinator in the PA program at CUNY York College in Jamaica, New York, and Jennifer is an associate professor in the PA program at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City. The authors have disclosed no potential conflicts of interest, financial or otherwise. In the abstract of this article, the authors pointed out a major flaw in the U.S. with our cervical cancer screening, and that is consistency. The authors mentioned that though there are guidelines for cervical cancer screening, several women are either being, quote, screened too frequently, overmanaged, end quote, and for women who are at higher risk, they're not being screened at all. This article helps clear up any confusion as it takes a look at the current guidelines for cervical cancer screening, reviews the different results patients can have after screening, and preventative measures we should be taking and discussing with our patients. For some quick epidemiology, 40 years ago, cervical cancer was the leading cause of death for women in the U.S. However, due to regular screening, this is no longer the case. Except, we still have some disparities. Black and Hispanic women have the highest incidence of cervical cancer, and Black women have the highest mortality rate. Quickly, some quick risk factors for cervical cancer are age, especially over 30, and the article mentions that the average age of diagnosis is 50, and women are most frequently diagnosed with cervical cancer between the ages of 35 and 44. Other risk factors include having multiple sex partners, unprotected sex, cigarette smoking, obesity, immunosuppression, poor nutrition and diet, and the most important, having the human papillomavirus, or HPV. Briefly, HPV is highly correlated with cervical cancer. There are several strains of HPV, however, strains 16 and 18 put patients at higher risk. Also, it's important to remember and to stress to patients, these strains are sexually transmitted. We should also remember that these strains not only place patients at risk for cervical cancer, but also anal, vulvar, vaginal, penile, oral pharyngeal, head and neck cancer. And before we get into what screening for cervical cancer entails, Nicolette, Brandon, at what age should you start screening your patient for cervical cancer?
This is really bringing me back to the pants. It's not something I usually think about in my day-to-day practice, but if I remember correctly, I think it's 21 years old.
Okay. Brandon?
I'm a second that. 21.
Okay. And how often should women be screened for cervical cancer?
I would say if it's negative, it's every 3 years. And I think if it's positive, like the atypical squamous, the ACUS, those things, you come back like every year, something like that.
Oh, geez. I also feel like it's 3 years, but I think there's some guidelines that it depends on your age. Like at a certain time, then it gets spaced out. I just don't remember at what age you can start spacing it out.
All right, we're gonna get to that. We'll see. We'll get to that. But taking a few steps back, What does cervical cancer screening do and how does it work? Essentially, the overall goal of cervical cancer screening is to identify precancerous cells before they transform into invasive cancer. And we do this by taking sample of cervical cells at the transformation zone. A quick review, the transformation zone is located where the area of cells from the external os transitions from columnar cells to squamous cells. And this area is where cervical cancer is most likely to develop first. This area is also referred to as the squamocolumnar junction. And we obtain sample of cells via a papanicolaou test, also known as a pap smear. So our screening guidelines. Currently, several organizations, including the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, American Academy of Family Practice, American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, American Society of Colposcopy and Clinical Pathology all recommend to start cervical cancer screening starting at age 21.
Yay.
Right. There's one organization that recommends screening to begin at age 25. Do you guys have any guess as to what organization suggests this?
I'm not good with the
organizations. I think I'm going to take a pass.
I'm not good with the organizations.
I'm not even going to guess.
I'm only asking this because I was pretty surprised, but it's the American Cancer Society. However, all of the organizations recommend that if solely screening for HPV, that this be done every 5 years and a pap smear every 3 years. It should be mentioned that each of them have their own separate recommendations in regard to co-testing and when to begin HPV testing, but it seems the general consensus is age 30 for separate HPV testing, so you were kind of on the right path there, Nicolette. And the article has a really nice chart that helps lay this out. There also seems to be an agreement on discontinuing cervical cancer screening at age 65 if your patient has had a negative screening over the last 10 consecutive years and they're not at high risk for cervical cancer. Additionally, those with a hysterectomy with removal of the cervix, with no history of high-grade cervical precancerous lesions or cervical cancer, they no longer need to undergo screening. So, abnormal screening. Let's say your patient has an abnormal result. What does this mean and what do we do? Brandon, you were touching on this earlier. Mm-hmm. Well, we all know that this all depends on the cytology results, and there are five possible results. The first being atypical glandular cells. This result is more concerning for precancerous or cancerous cells, as glandular cells are usually found inside the inner canal of the cervix and the uterus. Atypical squamous cells, these simply indicate that changes have occurred in the cervical cells. However, what specifically those changes mean, further testing needs to occur to help determine that. There's also low-grade intraepithelial lesions. This means that cervical cells have mild abnormal changes that are usually secondary to HPV infection. But in healthy patients, this usually resolves on its own. There's high-grade intraepithelial lesions. This means cervical cell changes are more severe and likely to be associated with precancer and cancer. And lastly, there's atypical squamous cells of undetermined significance, also known as ascus. These results indicate cervical cell changes are associated with HPV infection, but can occur with negative HPV results. When this happens, it's likely due to inflammation or vaginal infection, and ascus is the most common abnormal pap smear result, and it usually resolves on its own in healthy patients as well. For follow-up testing, overall the article refers to the ASCCP guidelines, as follow-up after an abnormal result can vary based on the patient's age and risk factors. But generally speaking, patients are either advised to repeat testing in 1 year after having an abnormal result, or sometimes they may need a colposcopy to help identify abnormal cells on the cervix. As always, education and communicating openly with patients improves compliance with screening and follow-up. And additionally to prevention, we need to discuss with our patients about risk factors for cervical cancer, such as obesity, cigarette use, lack of condom use. All of these things are of equal importance. And lastly, HPV vaccination. This is the most helpful as it gives protection against HPV strains that are highly associated with cancer risk. Currently, there is only one HPV vaccine distributed in the U.S., and that is approved for both males and females ages 9 to 45. I know that in last month's episode, we discussed vaccine hesitancy with COVID-19 and public health initiatives and our frustrations surrounding this. And I understand why some people face vaccine hesitancy, but we have a vaccine that prevents cancer. cancer. And this is something I'm really passionate about because I did my graduate project specifically on cervical cancer screening in Black women. And because of some of the stats mentioned in this article, Black women have the highest risk of mortality from cervical cancer. And I think a lot of this has to do with HPV vaccine hesitancy, screening hesitancy, that kind of unfortunately stems from lack of distrust in the medical community. But with that being said, and tying it into last month's article on public health, on a public health front, we really need to do a better job bridging that gap and regaining that trust, but also do a better job of explaining and educating patients early on. Brandon, Nicolette, what are your thoughts?
I support the vaccine initiative in terms of the HPV. My pediatrician did a great job. I'm looking back at it, did a great job explaining it to my mom, because I think I got the vaccine when I was still in middle school. So being able to explain to a parent while the child is in there, like, hey, like, even though you're not sexually active right now, this can save somebody's life, like, later on in time. And the way that she just, like, presented it, and definitely I feel it's kind of like the whole COVID thing, like, you don't do it as a man, I can't get cervical cancer, but because that's as you had,
you can get penile and anal cancer.
Very much so, but that wasn't, I was going to say that's what I learned in this article. Because back then, I remember they only spoke on it as a cause for cervical cancer. But understanding, I'm glad my mom recognized that, hey, this is not for my son, but this could be for someone else's child who could get this later on in life, because we wanted to be selfish and not get the vaccine for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. So I do think, like you said, early education is primary in helping to reduce these things. And it shows the importance of all primary care pediatricians that they play in the grand scheme of things. Like, this is something you get that gets addressed as a preteen teenager. And this is something that could affect you when you're 40, 50 years old, and possibly end your life. So, I liked how you spoke on the early intervention, the early education.
Yeah, I think it's so important. I mean, unfortunately, usually when I see patients with cervical cancer, it's towards the end of the disease course, and it's too late. So, you know, the more we could raise awareness about frequent screening and prevention through the vaccine, you know, hopefully they will see less and less of patients ending up in the ICU with, you know, horrible preventable complications of cervical cancer.
Yeah. I also get very frustrated when I see a patient with cervical cancer, especially when it's like end of life, because this could have been easily prevented. But, and also looking back on Brandon's point, and this is something I noticed too at the end, I was like, you know, this is an initiative on all fronts, pediatricians, primary care, gynecology. It's a group effort. But yeah.
Well, thank you everyone for listening to this month's podcast. And Nicolette, thank you for joining us today.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much, Nicolette. We enjoyed having you and discussing these articles with you. And thank you so much for your amazing article and your contribution to the PA profession.
Thank you guys for having me. It was so fun.
Yes. And for our listeners, please be sure that you're following JAPA on social media. Their Instagram handle is JAPAOnline. And under the September issue post, let us know your thoughts about the topics we went over today. We'd love to hear your input.
We look forward to October's podcast.